Sequoia, Tuesday, October 12th, 4:30 p.m. The forest floor was dark and cool. Shafts of sunlight filtered down from the magnificent trees rising all around them. The air smelled of pine. The ground was soft underfoot. It was a pleasant spot, with sunlight dappling the forest floor. But even so, the television cameras had to turn on their lights to film the third-grade school children who sat in concentric circles around the famous actor and activist, Ted Bradley. Bradley was wearing a black T-shirt that set off his makeup and his dark, good looks. "These glorious trees are your birthright," he said, gesturing all around him. "They have been standing here for centuries, long before you were born, before your parents or your grandparents or your great-grandparents were born. Some of them before Columbus came to America, before the Indians came, before anything. These trees are the oldest living things on the planet. They are the guardians of the earth. They are wise, and they have a message for us. Leave the planet alone. Don't mess with it or with us. And we must listen to them." The kids stared, open-mouthed, transfixed. The cameras were trained on Bradley. "But now, these magnificent trees, having survived the threat of fire, the threat of logging, the threat of soil erosion, the threat of acid rain, now face their greatest threat ever, global warming. You kids know what global warming is, don't you?" Hands went up all around the circle.
"I know, I know."
"I'm glad you do," Bradley said, gesturing for the kids to put their hands down. The only person talking today would be Ted Bradley. "But you may not know that global warming is going to cause a very sudden change in our climate. Maybe just a few months or years, and it will suddenly be much hotter or much colder. And there will be hordes of insects and diseases that will take down these wonderful trees."
"What kind of insects?" one kid asked.
"Bad ones," Bradley said. "The ones that eat trees, that worm inside them and chew them up." He wiggled his hands, suggesting the worming in progress.
"It would take an insect a long time to eat a whole tree," a girl offered.
"No, it wouldn't," Bradley said. "That's the trouble, because global warming means lots and lots of insects will come. A plague of insects, and they'll eat the trees fast." Standing to one side, Jennifer leaned close to Evans. "Do you believe this shit?" Evans yawned. He had slept on the flight up, and had dozed off again in the ride from the airport to this grove in Sequoia National Park. He felt groggy now, looking at Bradley. Groggy and bored. By now the kids were fidgeting, and Bradley turned squarely to the cameras. He spoke with the easy authority he had mastered while playing the president for so many years on television. "The threat of abrupt climate change," he said, "is so devastating for mankind and for all life on this planet that conferences are being convened all around the world to deal with it. There is a conference in Los Angeles starting tomorrow, where scientists will discuss what we can do to mitigate this terrible threat. But if we do nothing, catastrophe looms, and these mighty, magnificent trees will be a memory, a postcard from the past, a snapshot of man's inhumanity to the natural world. We're responsible for catastrophic climate change, and only we can stop it." He finished, with a slight turn to favor his good side, and a piercing stare from his baby blues right into the lens.
"I have to pee-pee," one girl said.
The plane lifted off the runway and rose over the forest. "Sorry to rush you," Evans said. "But we have to get to the morgue before 6.
No problem, no problem. Bradley smiled indulgently. After his talk, he had taken a few minutes to sign autographs for the kids. The cameras filmed that as well. He turned to Jennifer, giving her his best smile.
And what do you do, Miss Hadley?
I'm on the global warming legal team.
Good, so you're one of us. How's the lawsuit going?
Just fine, she said, glancing at Evans.
I get the feeling you're as brilliant as you are beautiful,
Bradley said.
Actually, no, she said.
Evans could see that the actor was annoying her.
You're being modest. It's very charming.
I'm being honest, she said,
and telling you I don't like flattery.
Hardly flattery in your case, he said.
And hardly honest in yours, she replied.
Believe me when I say that I genuinely admire what you're doing,
Bradley said.
I can't wait for you people to stick it to the EPA. We have to keep the pressure on. That's why I did this thing with the kids. It's a surefire television segment for abrupt climate change. And I thought it went extremely well, didn't you?
Reasonably well, considering.
Considering?
That it was all bullshit, Jennifer said. Bradley's smile remained fixed, but his eyes narrowed.
I'm not sure what you're referring to, he said.
I'm referring to all of it, Ted. The whole speech. Sequoias are sentinels and guardians of the planet. They have a message for us?
Well, they do. They're trees, Ted. Big trees. They have about as much of a message for mankind as an eggplant.
I think you're missing. And they've managed to survive forest fires?
Hardly. They're dependent on fires, because that's how they reproduce. Redwoods have tough seeds that only burst open in the heat of a fire. Fires are essential for the health of the redwood forest.
I think, Bradley said rather stiffly, that you may have missed my point.
Really? What did I miss?
I was trying to convey, perhaps a bit lyrically, the timeless quality of these great primeval forests. And
timeless? Primeval?
Do you know anything about these forests?
Yes, I think I do.
His voice was tight. He was visibly angry now.
Look out the window, Jennifer said, pointing to the forest as they flew above it. How long do you think your primeval forest has looked the way it does now?
Obviously, for hundreds of thousands of years.
Not true, Ted. Human beings were here for many thousands of years before these forests ever appeared. Did you know that?
He was clenching his jaw. He did not answer.
Then let me lay it out for you, she said.
20,000 years ago, the Ice Age glaciers receded from California, gouging out Yosemite Valley and other beauty spots as they left. As the ice walls withdrew, they left behind a gunky, damp plain with lots of lakes fed by the melting glaciers, but no vegetation at all. It was basically wet sand. After a few thousand years, the land dried as the glaciers continued to move farther north. This region of California became Arctic tundra, with tall grasses supporting little animals like mice and squirrels. Human beings had arrived here by then, hunting the small animals and setting fires.
Okay, so far, Jennifer said. No primeval forests yet.
I'm listening, Ted growled.
He was clearly trying to control his temper. She continued. At first, Arctic grasses and shrubs were the only plants that could take hold in the barren glacial soil. But when they died, they decomposed, and over thousands of years, a layer of topsoil built up. And that initiated a sequence of plant colonization that was basically the same everywhere in post-glacial North America. First, lodgepole pine comes in. That's around 14,000 years ago.
Later, it's joined by spruce, hemlock, and alder, trees that are hardy but can't be first. These trees constitute the real primary forest, and they dominated this landscape for the next 4,000 years. Then the climate changed. It got much warmer, and all the glaciers in California melted. There were no glaciers at all in California back then. It was warm and dry, there were lots of fires, and the primary forest burned. It was replaced by a plains-type vegetation of oak trees and prairie herbs, and a few Douglas fir trees, but not many, because the climate was too dry for fir trees. Then, around 6,000 years ago, the climate changed again. It became wetter, and the Douglas fir, hemlock, and cedar moved in and took over the land, creating the great closed canopy forests that you see now. But someone might refer to these fir trees as a pest plant, an oversized weed that invaded the landscape, crowding out the native plants that had been there before them. Because these big canopy forests made the ground too dark for other trees to survive. And since there were frequent fires, the closed canopy forests were able to spread like mad. So they're not timeless, Ted. They're merely the last in line. Bradley snorted. They're still 6,000 years old, for God's sake. But Jennifer was relentless. Not true, she said. Scientists have shown that the forests continually change their composition. Each thousand-year period was different from the one before it. The forests changed constantly, Ted. And then, of course, there were the Indians. What about them? The Indians were expert observers of the natural world, so they realized that old-growth forests sucked. Those forests may look impressive, but they're dead landscapes for game. So the Indians set fires, making sure the forests burned down periodically. They made sure there were only islands of old-growth forest in the midst of plains and meadows. The forests that the first Europeans saw were hardly primeval. They were cultivated, Ted. And it's not surprising that 150 years ago there was less old-growth forest than there is today. The Indians were realists. Today it's all romantic mythology. She sat back in her chair. Well, that's a very nice speech, Bradley said. But those are technical objections. People aren't interested. And it's a good thing because you're saying that these forests aren't really old and therefore aren't worth preserving. Whereas I say, they are reminders of the beauty and power of the natural world and should be preserved at all costs, especially from the dire threat of global warming. Jennifer blinked. She said, I need a drink. I'll join you there, Bradley said. For Evans, who had intermittently been attempting to call Detective Perry while this discussion was taking place, the most disturbing aspect was the implication of constant change. Evans had never really focused on the idea that Indians had lived at the same time as the glaciers. Of course, he knew that this was true. He knew that early Indians had hunted the mammoth and other large mammals to extinction. But he had never considered the possibility that they would also have burned forests and changed the environment to suit their purposes. But of course they had. Equally disturbing was the image of so many different forests taking over, one after another. Evans had never wondered what had existed before the redwood forests. He too had considered them primeval. Nor had he ever thought about the landscape that the glaciers would have left behind. Thinking about it now, he realized that it probably looked like the land he had recently seen in Iceland, cold, wet, rocky, and barren. It stood to reason that generations of plants would have to grow there, building up a layer of topsoil. But in his mind, he had always imagined a sort of animated movie in which the glaciers receded and redwood trees popped up immediately along the receding edge. The glaciers pulled away, leaving redwood forest behind. He realized now how silly that view had been. And Evans had also noticed, in passing, how frequently Jennifer had spoken of a changing climate. First it was cold and wet, then it was warm and dry, and the glaciers melted. Then it was wetter again, and the glaciers came back, changing and changing again. Constant change. After a while, Bradley excused himself and went to the front of the plane to call his agent. Evans said to Jennifer, "How did you know all that stuff?" "For the reason Bradley himself mentioned, the dire threat of global warming. We had a whole team researching dire threats because we wanted to find everything we could find to make our case as impressive as possible." "And?" She shook her head. "The threat of global warming," she said, "is essentially non-existent. Even if it were a real phenomenon, it would probably result in a net benefit to most of the world." The pilot clicked on the intercom, telling them to take their seats because they were on their final approach to San Francisco.